is David Marsh. I'm the chairman of OnFIF. I'm calling in from London. Peter Foster is the public policy editor of the Financial Times. He's calling from Brighton. Brighton has been in the Financial Times bylines much more often than normal as a result of the lockdown, more often than maybe during party conferences even in the last few weeks. Peter, it was announced that he was joining the FT after being on the Telegraph for many years. It was announced in January, just before the COVID crisis started, and he's really been quite a stalwart of the FT's coverage in the last few months since he started in April. He's got a lot of global experience as well, having been also the European editor and the US editor for the Telegraph, worked in New Delhi. So he's bringing quite a roving eye to the public policy function at the FT. And he's produced a lot of scoops, as we know, mostly in the micro area, the all important area of industry, freight, transport, and so on, the things that keep us going. But also latterly, his biggest scoop was the one that he brought out last month about the rule of law being broken in a limited and specific way, as the Northern Ireland Secretary famously put it, over the internal market bill. So thanks for being with us, Peter. First of all, that big story that you broke last month, what effect do you think that's had on the general atmosphere of the talks as they're still proceeding?
A negative effect, in short, David. Talking to diplomats around about, even our friends, that you know, the Swedes and the Dutch, you know, the Germans, it landed heavily with them. I think if they thought that they were dealing with the same kind of British government as Theresa May ran, I think that decision to not rattle sabres, but to actually write clauses into a piece of legislation that would legally disapply, strike out commitments that we'd ratified only in January, did land very heavily in European capitals. Remarkable that Theresa May, the immediate predecessor of Boris Johnson from the same party, should stand up on the back benches and call out her successor for what he'd done. And I think it was a wake-up call on the European side, and it's not made the negotiation any easier. They've been, as they would say in Brussels in a slightly snooty way, very grown up about it. They haven't thrown their toys out the pram. But a lot of European member states feel that it has made getting a deal more difficult because they want tougher governance mechanisms. And of course, the last thing that Boris Johnson wants is any more oversight than strictly necessary from the European Union. So to that extent, it's actually made the kind of technical business of getting this deal into a space that both sides can live with more difficult, the trust issues aside.
We'll go into the general meteorology of the deal in a moment, but just sticking to the internal market bill, you mentioned Theresa May, there's also some Tory stalwarts, not least Michael Howard, as well as people like Norman Lamont, but above all Howard, who really did cast aspersions on whether the government was being, in your words, grown up. Now, in Mrs. Thatcher's day, she used to say to her diplomatic friends, as you know, when she was dealing with the Italians, for example, is it guile or is it incompetence? In terms of this, do you think Boris Johnson and his merry men always intended all along not to stick to the absolute letter of the deal? Because he has made lots of comments about there shouldn't be a border in the Irish Sea. Or do you think it was something that they just kind of discovered by argument and by accident, and they thought they might be able to get it through on the night without anybody really looking? Can you explore a little bit what you think might have been the motivations for this breach?
You know, I think there's been some quite ex post justification. I think the original motivation for it was that the Brexit deal or no deal that they've pivoted towards is one that absolutely prioritises sovereignty, the unencumbrance of the United Kingdom's legal and regulatory systems by Brussels, by the big regulatory behemoth on the UK's doorstep. And the more you prioritise sovereignty, the more incompatible the Northern Irish Protocol becomes with that, leaving Northern Ireland as a regulatory vassal, if you want to be emotive about it, of the European Union. The European Northern Ireland, part of the United Kingdom, will follow EU customs rules. All the goods that go from Great Britain into Northern Ireland must follow EU customs rules. And where there are tariffs to be paid, where there's a risk of goods being smuggled into the single market across the non-existent border in Ireland, those tariffs need to be paid. The state aid section of that bill, Northern Ireland must follow EU state aid rules for goods. But if the UK makes a state aid decision, that potentially cuts into Northern Ireland, then the Commission has scope there. So the protocol was inimical to a very purist, sovereigntist Brexit. Now, after the fact, I think they were shocked by the reaction in Washington, the reaction in Europe, the reaction from some of the party, Michael Howard, you mentioned, Norman Lamont. And I think there has been a somewhat chastening experience. But fundamentally, this is a gun on the table. It is saying, if you don't implement the protocol in the way we see fit, we will implement it unilaterally. And you can dice around that whichever way you like. Oh, it's tactical bluster. It's just getting the Europeans to see sense. Yes, to a point. But fundamentally, it is a repudiation of the deal that Johnson signed. And when you get into the European side of this, it starts to feel quite cynical. Subsequent to that story that I wrote on the UK Internal Market Bill, broke a story which showed very clearly that the legal advice the government had at the time of the negotiation was very clear about the potential of the protocol to reach into the UK on state aid, Article 10. But nonetheless, Johnson signed it, and he signed it so he could have an oven-ready deal and get a majority. And to European eyes, it does look somewhat as if, well, I've got an eight-seat majority, I've changed my tune now, and now I want to rewrite it. And that, you know, back to your original question, David, doesn't engender confidence when you're trying to get a free trade negotiation, zero tariff, zero quota access, where a lot of it's going to have to be sort of based around trust. Look, we're the same on day one. We don't want to diverge that far. Come on, do we really need this aggressive dispute resolution mechanism? All of that made more difficult by what looks like quite a cynical manoeuvre.
As I say, if we could sum up what you've just said in two words, it looks like callous cynicism to me. Now, getting into where we are now, you don't follow all the political aspects of this as much as some of the other colleagues in the FT, but you've clearly got your ear quite closely to the ground. You wrote a piece in the FT a few days ago saying, look for the sound of silence when people are not actually giving too many briefings in the days before 15th of October. Then that's a good sign because they're getting down to the real nitty-gritty of the business, the swearing off the fisheries against the state aid and that kind of thing. Michael Gove has said just a few hours ago, 66% is a chance for a deal. Where would you, as a betting or a non-betting man, where would you put your money at the moment?
I think I'm pretty much with Michael Gove. They often say that, but I'd say I'm about 60-40 for a deal. There are huge macro forces that push us towards a deal. I can construct scenarios where a deal doesn't happen. I think accidents can happen. I think there's a danger that both sides overestimate the extent to which the other is willing to compromise. You know, the EU generally runs these things. It runs them into the end zone. Johnson didn't ask for an extension transition period. And the EU sees a kind of 80-20 fold coming. You know, Johnson moves 80% of the way. They tinker around the edges and, you know, a deal gets done. That may be a miscalculation. As I say, this is all about sovereignty. This is not Theresa May's government. This is a government that focuses on values, that sells Brexit as a values proposition. And if they push Johnson too hard, and it's a mug's game reading the mind of Boris Johnson, so I'm not going to pretend to be able to do it. But if they push him too hard, I suspect an accident can happen. I do think that they think the political cost of a deal that looks too servile will be greater than the cost of a no deal and the disruption that might flow from a no deal. Now, where that fulcrum lies, where the tipping of the scale lies, you know, depends on how hard the EU push and how far Johnson's prepared to go. But I do think a deal absolutely can be done. It should be done, but it's not a done deal and accidents can happen.
No, well, let's not go too much into that because, as you say, nobody can really read the runes of what's going on in Mr. Johnson's, or indeed, to be fair, anybody else's mind. Let's go into the more intricate details. You've run a lot of stories about the freight industry, and there seems to be a thread running through this narrative going back all the time to the months before the Brexit referendum in 2016, where the Brexiteers weren't all that worried about the details. They thought it would somehow come good on the night. There has been a lot of antagonism by the freight industry. And of course, ordinary people living in Kent, for example, faced with the prospect of massive lorry queues and so on. Do you think, again, that the government just hasn't had time or energy or enthusiasm to pay attention to the details? And so this has been an accident waiting to happen, to have these kind of problems coming here, really, more or less at the 11th hour.
Yes, and COVID hasn't helped in between, because a lot of the civil servants that were working on this got switched onto COVID. But more importantly, and this is where the the government, I think, struggles. Business has just been engaged in the business of survival. And yes, the government can produce a new computer system, although, by the way, it hasn't yet. The goods vehicle movement system is still not rolled out, nor is the smart freight portal that's going to be used to regulate vehicles going into Kent. So that's on the government. IT's not been in place early enough. The French SI Brexit system has been in place for well over a year. It's been fully trialled, and that's the system by which lorries will approach the border and get a barcode and get a green or an orange signal about which way they're going to go. We'll have a similar system, but it needs to be up and running, and business needs to adjust to it. And this is the big issue, I think, is that government and Whitehall struggles to understand market forces sometimes. So they have spent £50 million on trying to incentivize the training of customs agents and freight forwards. We'll do 260 or 70 million new customs declarations, according to the HMRC estimates. And you're going to need a lot of freight forwarders to do that because they're complicated. You know, export, you read the border operating model, it's a fearsomely complicated document. So why hasn't everyone with a spare shed opened a customs office like the government hoped? I mean, Michael Gove, I think, has got quite exasperated with industry not taking up the slack. There's money to be made. There's great opportunity here. Why not? Well, you know, industry has been in the business of actually furloughing customs agents of late because of the crunch caused by COVID. Business is not in the mood to lard on risk, particularly when it doesn't know exactly how this deal's going to go down, although deal or no deal, there are going to be significant new frictions. And it's been several times up to the edge of this cliff, and then something's been done to delay or smooth it out or implement it. And therefore, business has struggled, and government is frustrated with business, but business has struggled to engage and adapt because of COVID and because this stuff is complicated and they don't actually know in great detail what's going to happen yet.
An example you wrote about in the middle of September, you said 2/3 of customs brokers don't have enough staff to handle the extra paperwork needed to trade across the border come the 1st of January. Whose fault is that then, quite frankly? Is it the freight industry? Is it the customs brokers? Is it the government for not providing the right framework?
I think the government should have been more aggressive in incentivizing customs brokers to expand. If you're going to ask someone to take on new risk, new staff, new computers, new office space at a time of the biggest economic crunch since whenever, 100 years, you need to do more than, you know, offer to pay £7,000 recruitment fees, etc. The proof is in the pudding, David. I don't know whose fault is, but the net result is there aren't enough customs agents. And I think everyone accepts that. And they take, 2 years to train. And so there is going to be, I think, disruption. Because when companies wake up to the need to get these forms filled and they get the yellow pages out as it used to be, or they go into Google and try and find the technical support they need, they're going to find experienced advice and support is hard to come by.
So we seem to be up with a problem of many, many different contours. We've got the COVID crisis, which after all is, as you say, a problem, an existential problem for many parts of industry and business. If you remember to the first days of Mrs. May's government, she put a bit of a force field around her in Downing Street, her advisers and industry. And that was overcome, I think, over the next 6 months. Industry felt that they were getting through to Downing Street. Mr. Johnson claimed that he would be trying to get close to the people. He did make that notorious remark, excuse me for using a swear word, he said fuck business in the days before he became the Prime Minister, because he felt they were sometimes pleading for things, lobbying for things which weren't all that necessary. Is there running through the government a cavalier spirit? And does this apply also to the civil service as well, who says, well, look, industry always complains, but they always get it right on the night, so we shouldn't pay too much attention to their special pleading? Or is there some deeper force at work?
I think the difficulty is that it's really hard to have good relations with business when you are overtly prioritising the ideological pursuit of sovereignty over the smooth running of supply chains. You know, it's quite hard to have a sort of civilized discussion about that, because the government hasn't really set out why it wants to put our trade with Europe, 50% of our trade goes into Europe, 43% of our goods exports, on the same footing as Canada's. Canada is not connected to the European Union by a pipe called the Channel Tunnel. So Boris Johnson says, I want to trade like Canada, but he doesn't really want to have a serious conversation, and nor do a lot of the government, about what that means for the chemicals industry and the pharmaceuticals industry. So, yes, the government has done its bit to try and mitigate the consequences of those ideological decisions, but it hasn't shied away from the fact that, well, we're prioritizing sovereignty. So that may mean that the car industry has to pay tariff. That will mean that the chemical industry is going to have dual registrations, £1 billion worth of costs to create a UK version of the EU chemicals REACH database in Helsinki for no other reason than we want to have a British one. You know, I've just been talking to the head of the European Chemicals Industries Association. You know, he has people coming over from China going, we don't understand why you're doing this to your neighbourhood. And, you know, when you plug that in, you can see why relations between business and government and business, government and industry are pretty tetchy, you know, because ultimately the government's saying, well, we don't care. You know, we promise sovereignty to the people. We've allowed Brexit to be defined. You know, Brexit means Brexit. Do you remember Theresa May said that? Now Brexit has come to mean the one true Brexit is having a trade deal like Canada's or, if necessary, like Australia's. It's become a sort of means unto itself, and business is going to have to suck up the cost, and ultimately the country will have to suck up the cost.
You know, it seems as though, from what you're saying, Peter, the people, you can either have sovereignty or you have jobs, but you can't have both. It almost seems as though that's what they're saying. But just before we get on to all that, just one word about your change of job. You used to work in a very distinguished fashion for the Daily Telegraph, which famously ran columns from Boris Johnson when he was, certainly when he was Mayor of London, I think part of the time when he was Foreign Minister as well, and for whom Mr. Johnson did used to work in a slightly wacky way from Brussels when he was the correspondent. Some of his stories were deadly true and serious, some were deadly untrue and deadly non-serious, and sometimes it's a bit difficult to make out the distinction. What has been the main change compared with working at the Daily Telegraph since you switched over to the FT, which I have to say, as a newspaper for which I have the highest esteem, that I used to work as well up until 1995. So what have been the contrast between those two stables, Peter?
I think, you know, the biggest contrast, I think, between the Telegraph and the FT, and I had 21 wonderful years at the Telegraph, and they were very good to me, and my editors, as you alluded to, David, my editors printed an awful lot of my journalism, which wasn't necessarily the house line. It's a broader church, I think, that it's given credit for. But the big difference about coming to the FT is the astonishing depth of colleagues. You know, it's a brains trust, the FT. It has, despite all of the headwinds facing media, facing newspapers, particularly the transition to trying to make money out of internet-based news, that the FT, and it strikes you the minute you walk in the door as a new boy, the FT has preserved its brains trust. It is prioritised investing in retaining talent. And when you work on stories, you very rarely see solo bylines at the FT because, you know, there's a real culture of collaboration. And that, you know, that's, it's the best and most brilliant thing, other than the wonderful graphics department.
They've always been very good. And of course, you do get quite a few bylines. As I say, you put Brighton up on in lights. I'm sure the town council of Brighton must be very happy that you're working there for several days in a week. This is David Marsh signing off now. Sure you'll be hearing from us again. If you've enjoyed the podcast, then please subscribe to our channel. We are on iTunes and we are on Spotify, and we look forward to further interaction with you all. Thank you very much indeed for listening.